Matty, and welcome to a new episode of the Gentleman Ultra podcast. If you are a little confused about the voice you're hearing, it's because I am deputising for Richard today, who I imagine is either licking his wounds at the start of the Interfire sale with Hakimi going to PSG or preparing himself for the big game tonight, Italy-Spain. So it's Luke Hodges-Ramon, your host today, and we are going to be discussing Euro 2004, Italy's campaign, failed campaigns. I'm not sure this is a great topic of discussion before one of Italy's biggest games in a decade or so tonight. But I'm joined by Emmett Gates, as always. Emmett, welcome. How are you doing?
Yeah, doing good, Luca. It's good to be back on the doing the pods again, looking back at Italy through various European championships, and obviously ahead of tonight's semi-final against Spain. But when you look back at this tournament, you just I know we're doing a podcast, but sometimes there's just you just think, what can you say about this edition?
Yeah, well, obviously, with it being a big day, as you said, Italy's semi-final against Spain, probably the biggest game, well, yeah, since Euro 2012, for sure, for the Italian national side, since they last met Spain. Well, not since they last met Spain, obviously they met in Euro 2016 as well. But getting this far in a major tournament, and yeah, we're going to be looking back on not so fond memories of the 2004 campaign, which saw a very talented Italy side fail to qualify from the group, and obviously yeah, go back over the infamous Scandinavian conspiracy or pragmatism, as whatever you like to call it, as we had an article actually on the Gentleman Ultra a few years ago about that very game between Denmark and Sweden that ultimately settled Italy's fate in the last round of the group stages, written by Ross Highfield. So we'll get onto that. But I guess the place to start really is to set the scene. Euro 2004, of course, being held in Portugal. Italy had what you would have thought from the outset, a relatively simple group with Sweden, Denmark, and I guess what were considered to be the whipping boys of the tournament, really, at the time, Bulgaria. And a very talented squad to call upon, managed by Giovanni Trapattoni, the head coach then. And obviously we'll get into her, and I'm sure, Emmett, you'll get into your thoughts about how Trapattoni managed this group of players shortly. But yeah, I mean, you go through the list of players in the Italy squad, and you had Buffon, obviously, in goal. At the back, you had Cannavaro, the captain, Panucci, Oddo, obviously Materazzi, Favalli,
Alessandro Nesta,
some really important and some of the greatest Italian defenders that we've had. Into the midfield, where again, spoilt for choice, Andrea Pirlo, Gattuso, Camoranesi, Stefano Fiore, Simone Perotta, a lot of the core of the team that went on to win the World Cup 2 years later, obviously. And then again in the forward areas, Totti, Del Piero, Vieri, Cassano, plenty of fantasisti in there. So you look at it on paper and you go, what? Well, Italy are one of the favourites for the tournament and should definitely be qualifying and getting through a group consisting of Sweden, Denmark and Bulgaria. So look, high expectations, as there always was for Italian sides, but obviously coming off the back of a really disappointing 2002 World Cup campaign, where again, we love conspiracy theories in Italy, and obviously the South Korean last round of 16 game where Italy were knocked out due to some dubious refereeing decisions. But again, maybe a bit of a warning sign, really, and a precursor to what happened in Euro 2004, is that Italy ultimately not taking chances in the game, reverting to the kind of conservative reactive approach and being punished for it. So yeah, I think we'll start by kind of going through the games in the group stage and using those games to analyze what went wrong, and what if were any of the standout moments for the Italian side. And then I'm looking forward to hearing your take on yeah, I guess how things unraveled throughout the tournament, and what, if anything, the lessons that were learned going into World Cup in 2006, which is obviously a very triumphant campaign under Marcello Lippi. probably the first lesson being learned that the coach was changed. But, but yeah, first game was against Denmark. And again, a Denmark side that were well organised and I think, you know, never an easy game coming up against one of the Scandinavian sides who you know were always going to be well coached, had some good individual players, but nowhere near the kind of level of talent the Italians had. And it was a drab nil-nil draw, a very what I would call typical first group stage game by an Italian side. So what are your memories of that game, Emmett, and what kind of struck you from looking back on it and how Italy started, apart from Totti, is obviously less said about the better of it. Obviously, spitting gate with was it Poulsen?
Yeah,
it was, and I know obviously ended up getting a 3-game ban for it.
Where to begin with this game? Honestly, I remember watching this game back in 2004. Honestly, it was one of the single worst games that I'd ever seen in my life up until that point. And it probably still is one of the worst games I've ever watched. It was, to call it drab would be a compliment to drab. It was.
Yeah, I was being kind there. It was the worst game of the tournament by far.
It was dire. Yeah. I mean, Trapattoni started out in a 4-2-3-1 system.
Do you want to run through that team, Emmett? I've got that team in front of me just to emphasise how poor Italy were considering the players that were out there.
Yeah, so he starts off, obviously, Gigi's in nets. Gianluca Zambrata, left back. Christian Panucci, right back. And Alain Asta and Fabio Cannavaro in central defence. Simone Perrotta and Zanetti as the double pivot in the middle, with Del Piero on the left, Totti as a trequartista, and Camoranesi on the right, and Bobo Vieri leading the charge. And you kind of look at that front four and you think, yeah, that's pretty good, but it's...
I would say exactly that. You look at that front four and you'd say, even with a very conservative double pivot, that should be enough to create some chances.
Yeah, but you just think...
And unlocked.
But you just think, what is he doing? He's got Andrea Pirlo and Rino Gattuso on the bench, and he starts Simone Perrotta and Cristiano Zanetti. And Perrotta and Zanetti, you know, were good pros, good solid pros, and will do a job. But Pirlo and Gattuso, at that point, were both starring for Milan, had won the Champions League the year prior in central midfield for Milan. So you think, you know, using logic, that you would take these two players who obviously have proven that they're a winning combination. And Milan had just won the Scudetto that season going into Euro 2004 with Pirlo and Gattuso in the middle. So you think, okay, just slot them in. But I don't know what Trapattoni
Already you're left scratching your head.
Yeah, exactly, and it was just one of many weird decisions that Trapattoni made in this tournament. And you look at the Denmark side, and I mean, there was Serie A experience here. You obviously had John Tal Thomason, who at the time was from Milan. You had Thomas Helveg, Martin Lawrenson, who was at
had
Milan.
Quite a strong Milan contingent.
Yeah.
Quite a strong Milan contingent. Maybe that's what Trapattoni was thinking.
And I think it's Martin Jorgensen, who was at Udinese at the time.
Udinese legend.
Yeah.
Yeah, Udinese, yeah.
And speaking of legends, then your former or future Juventus legend, Christian Poulsen, in midfield, and we'll get to him in a minute.
Absolutely.
But this game was dire. I was 17 when this game happened, and I remember it being truly dreadful. And if you go to YouTube and you try to type in highlights of this game, nothing comes up. All you can find is Totti spitting on the back of Christian Poulsen's head. And I would say, if you...
And that says a lot when that's the highlight of the game, doesn't it? Really, that says a lot how low you have to stoop to find a kind of flashpoint from the game itself.
And I would put money on that if me and you talked to every Italy player that played in that game, they would remember precisely nothing from it except for Totti's spit game. There's some nil-nils that, like the other day on the TGU account, I put up it was 15 years since Italy-Germany, you know, in Dortmund, the semi-final in 2006 World Cup. Like, that was nil-nil for 119 minutes, but it was brilliant. It was a brilliant nil-nil game. This fantastic is on the opposite end of the spectrum. This was just, beyond dire. Beyond dire.
Yeah, and I think about this game that really struck me, and it was very typical of an opening Italian game in a tournament.
Yeah.
Very, you have high hopes, you look at the lineup and you think, even without Pirlo and Gattuso, and I think it's strange that Pirlo didn't even feature at all in the game. He doesn't even get brought on off the bench. The substitutes are Cassano, Stefano Fiore and Gattuso. But you're just disillusioned after the first 90 minutes because it's been so dour. But at the same time, a classic kind of Italian, we just don't lose the game.
Make sure
that, you know, you keep a clean sheet, take the point, move on to the next, get through the group. Doesn't really matter. Put it behind the Italian side. Ultimately, as we'll go on to discuss, it proved costly, probably. It did. But very, very representative, I think, of Italian national sides opening tournaments and starting very slowly.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's always it's almost become a cliche now that Italy starts slowly at tournaments and, you know, as the tournament progresses, they get more into it and they kind of get the rhythm going. So you kind of think, yeah, this is Italy being Italy. Slow start, but eventually they'll go through the gears. They'll win, you know, the remaining two games of the group and advance into the quarterfinal, or so you hope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, and that's what I guess has been so refreshing about this Italian side that we watch now, is you couldn't believe the pace at which and they hit the ground running and the football they were playing from the off. I mean, it can in complete and stark contrast to this Italian side. And I think ultimately that set the tempo really for the rest of the tournament. Unfortunately, they couldn't get out of that second gear in an underwhelming set of performances.
Yeah, and I mean, then Totti, obviously the cameras pick up Totti spitting at the back of Christian Poulsen's hair, and he gets suspended for three games retroactively, and so Totti isn't available until the quarterfinal or the semi-final, if Italy had have got that far.
Yeah,
and I think that kind of, as you say, that set in motion almost like this victimization. Oh, we're the victims here. You know, the referee didn't see it, but it's happening retroactively. And through, you know, this was VAR before VAR. because the decision comes like two or three days later. And so I think this kind of suited the Italian mindset at the time. You know, this is following on from, obviously, what we're playing the Pescato in the third game, but it's kind of this, per us, we're getting victimized here, just like in the 2002 World Cup. And it's just, you just feel like, no, just go out and win your games. It's still within your own hands. You can still do this, and you're good enough. You have the players to do it.
Yeah. Like you said, I mean, we're all Italian fans here, and we all, don't get me wrong, I'm the first to subscribe to a conspiracy theory or to try and claim that we've been hard done by, but look, he spat at a player. There's nothing to complain about. It's a kind of false mentality of we're being victimized when, as you say, played poorly, put it behind us onto the next game, and put it right. And as you said, it's not as if this Italian side didn't have the players to replace Totti. Cassano comes in that trequartista role. Still one of the most talented players of a generation and can easily fill Totti's boots, both in terms of his ability and his ego and presence on the pitch. So it was no issue, really. And that did obviously carry forward to the Sweden game. And this, where I felt, was actually a good Italian performance, or a much better Italian. I remember watching this game. But again, being very representative of my memories of Italian tournament performances which went wrong, in that they score the first goal, they have chances to kill the game off. When they don't kill the game off, naturally they come back into a conservative kind of mentality of defend what we have and get punished often, and can lead to being, no matter how good the defence is, with Nesta and Cannavaro and Buffon, when you've got someone like Ibrahimovic who can pull off a piece of magic, you get punished. And so that's how this game really unfurled. But again, what are your memories of this game, Emmett, and where did the turning points come, and what could have been different? And the game finished 1-1. Sorry for anyone who doesn't recall the game. The goals from Cassano, who came in for Totti, at the end of the first half, if I remember rightly, and then Ibrahimovic with 5 or so minutes to go. And I'll let you describe the goal, because it's one of the kind of memorable goals of the Euros. But yeah, what are your memories of the game?
Yeah, I think you summarized it up, you know, pretty succinctly. This was the first 45 minutes of this half. Italy were scintillating, and it was arguably as good as Italy played in the whole Trapattoni era. Like, they blew Sweden away in the first 45 minutes, and Alessandro Del Piero, who always flattered to deceive for Italy, you know, he was always, to me, Del Piero is always a Juventus player, as opposed to, he was the reverse Roberto Baggio. Baggio left his best performances for Italy, whereas Del Piero was the opposite. His best performances come in the black and white of Juve. But in this 45 minutes, he was brilliant. There's a lovely Zidane-esque Marseille roulette he pulls off down the left. And him, Vieri, and Cassano were exceptional in that opening 45 minutes. And honestly, it was as enterprising as Italy played in the
And we
whole.
should say Pirlo and Gattuso were brought back in,
Yeah,
which I
so.
think says everything you need to know about that decision in the first game.
Trapattoni saw sense and brought in Pirlo and Gattuso, and Simone Perrotta is the other one, and he almost goes to like a 4-3-1-2 now, as opposed to a 4-2-3-1, and he moves Del Piero closer to Bobo Vieri, because in the first game he plays Del Piero like on the left, but Del Piero was nearly 30 at that point and didn't have the legs that a 20-year-old Alessandro Del Piero had to go up and down. So he moved him closer as like a secondo punta, second striker type position, and Del Piero did better. But it's like you said, they missed Vieri at chances, Cassano at chances, Del Piero at chances. They missed six or seven chances to, you know, double their advantage or triple their advantage.
Alex Del Piero, wonderful turn. Del Piero! Oh, that's a fabulous save.
As the game progressed and it was still 1-0, you kind of felt, you know, Sweden could equalize here,
Yeah,
because Italy
you've got
are.
that sinking feeling as
Yeah.
as an Italy fan. I remember watching it, getting very nervous and thinking this could, I mean, I think Buffon makes a fantastic save shortly before Ibra equalizes.
Still Larsen for the Swedes. Great ball. Fantastic save by Gianluigi Buffon. One of the saves of the tournament.
As you say, Vieri had one of those tournaments where, again, Bobo Vieri, such an emphatic forward in his club form, just didn't fire really in terms of taking chances in this tournament. And then again, you look at the Sweden side and going forward, very talented. Ibra leading the line with Larsen, Henrik Larsen, Freddie Ljungberg in behind with Anders Svensson. Some real talent going forward. So they always had that ability to punish you, really. And they had just demolished Bulgaria in the first game, 5-0, which ultimately, again, you know, Italy can have always tended not to approach tournament games like that and being very ruthless and finishing teams off. So I think the Sweden team had that attacking ruthlessness and flair where they were always going to be a threat if you didn't kill a game off.
Yeah, exactly. And the longer the game went on, you kind of felt Sweden could get something here. And it comes from a corner. Their goal, Ibra's goal, comes from a corner.
Kjellström, very deep corner. Jakobsen heads it back in, pushed across the face of goal. Melberg's in there. Freddie Ljungberg goes over the goalkeeper. Hasn't got this, got in! It's Ibrahimovic! Sweden a level! Unbelievable!
And the ball kind of bounces around in the box. And I think there's a header from Olof Melberg. He kind of directs it more towards the center of the goal, and Freddie Ljungberg goes up to challenge with it with Zambrada, but both of them missed the ball, and so it's just bouncing in like from 7 yards out, 8 yards out. Gigi Buffon runs out to try and meet it, but he's just narrowly beaten to the ball by Ibrahimovic, who does this unbelievable martial arts back heel, jumping back heel.
And
Christian Vieri's on the goal line, and the ball literally just, there's not much to aim for. There's a gap between Bobo Vieri's head and the crossbar, and the ball just loops in, and Vieri jumps, and Vieri's like 6'1", 6'2".
Even when
he's jumping, he still can't reach the ball. It just goes through this small gap and into the goal. And it was unbelievable. Yeah. And you think this was the first time Ibrahimovic had done something like this. So you kind of felt, it was lucky. But then you see how his career turned out and the amount of times he scored goals like that. And you realize that it was just part of his arsenal. Like, he had that ability.
Yeah, every part of that goal.
You realize that he absolutely did mean it. And that was the goal that put Ibrahimovic on the map. And Juve would end up buying him at the end of that transfer window based purely on that goal.
No, it's... I would go as far as saying it's a 1 in 1,000 goal in terms of not just because of the execution, and Ibra's one of the only players in the world who could have executed it like that with his dynamism and his flexibility and his explosive power to jump that high, get his leg that high. But also the fact that, as you said, Vieri's on the line. He's not off the line.
Yeah.
It loops over Vieri on the line. So it couldn't have been, you know, inch higher it hits the bar, inch lower Vieri heads it away. So it's, incredible goal. Probably, again, fed a bit into that, you know, what do Italy have to do? This kind of victimhood of, you know, what can you do about that? It was very, I think, deflating in a game that Italy did play well in and should have comfortably won, or should have comfortably had the game sewn up by then. Obviously, it set up with Denmark winning in the other game against Bulgaria 2-0. It set up this scenario, which we'll obviously talk about now, Emmett, in which essentially things were out of Italy's hands if a certain result between two Scandinavian sides materialised. And obviously, in normal circumstances, were it two sides, I don't know, I'm just plucking two names here, but if it was Holland against Germany or Holland, you definitely wouldn't have that idea where two big rivals or two different European countries would probably look at a 2-2 result and go, we can play a 2-2 draw out. But Denmark and Sweden both being Scandinavian countries, Italy, you know, being renowned as a country where the biscotto, you know, where you play out a result that's favourable to both teams, is a well-known phenomenon in the Italian division in Serie A and Serie B in Italian football, where they've got a word for it, the biscuit, playing out that result that's favourable to both sides.
You take a bit, I take a bit.
And of course, that's what dominates now the Italian press leading in. It doesn't matter what we do against Bulgaria. We know what the result's going to be between Denmark and Sweden. It's almost a forlorn hope. And I guess that is exactly what came to pass. But do you want to explain, I think it was quite a complex ruling, why the 2-2 knocked Italy out, Emmett, if you remember what the logic
I think
was
because there. Italy and Denmark, they were level on goal difference, so it went head-to-head. And basically a 2-2 would mean Denmark would advance on...
Goals scored against Sweden.
Because Italy was 1-1, and then it needed, obviously, the 2-2 then would have suited both teams, and they go through. But from my point of view, if you're going to fix a game, surely a 2-2 is one of the hardest scorelines to fix, because that's four goals that, you know, that's two goals apiece that each side need to let in, so we say, and not make it look suspicious. Like, it's not, you're not talking 1-0 here or 1-1, like, two each is a pretty difficult scoreline to try and, you know, manipulate to make sure both sides go through. So, to me, I just think it was Italy's fault. It was Trapattoni's fault. You know, I don't subscribe to the Biscotto theory. Obviously, you know, you can manipulate the narrative to your liking. But at the end of the day, if Italy beat Sweden, we aren't having this conversation.
No, simple as that. Italy put themselves in this position, and I think so. I'm gonna play devil's advocate, and we'll go through the Italy-Bulgaria game, because that in itself was an ordeal, and Italy even nearly managed to mess that up in terms of not beating Bulgaria and you know, sticking to their part of the deal. But setting the scene, yeah, so Italy obviously have to win against Bulgaria, which everyone takes for granted, because Bulgaria have been beaten by Denmark, beaten by Sweden 5-0, and then hope that Sweden and Denmark don't play out this 2-2 biscotto. Obviously, now looking back, there have been, you know, the Italian press got hold of it straight away. Comments made between the Danish and Swedish players during the game. Comments made before, where obviously the Danish and Swedish players played it down and said exactly what you said, Emmett. 2-2 is not exactly an easy result to play out. You know, the Scandinavians, we're good, honest people. We're just going to play to win. And from what I remember of that game, and we'll speak about the Italy game in a second, Denmark were the much better side in that game, and played very well. And it was Sweden who scored late on and equalised 2-2, I think in like the 88th minute, if I'm right in remembering that. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So let's go to the Italy game first, and then I'm going to play devil's advocate and read out some of the things that were being said in the press and some of the comments that were allegedly made between the Sweden-Denmark players. Because me personally, I remember it very well, and I remember Cassano scoring in the last minute, thinking he'd sent Italy through.
Yeah, that's my abiding memory of Italy-Bulgaria game, is Cassano celebrating, falling to his knees, and then the tears just start to stream down his face when he realises that it's in vain.
Yeah, and that was very much, may as well have been a kind of mirror image of what was going on in my lounge at that point as a 12-year-old. Just kind of the realisation that, yeah, the Scandinavians have have sent us crashing out. So in one way, I did hold a grudge for a long time. It's, you know, blame it on Sweden and Denmark. We are done by. Another conspiracy theory after 2002. We were cheated by the South Koreans and the referee. We were cheated by the Swedish and the Danes.
Everybody's against us.
Yeah, everyone's against us. And I made a joke about this with one of my Swedish friends when they obviously knocked Italy out of the qualifiers for the World Cup in 2016. I said, I'd still not forgiven you for 2004. So this is it for me. Sweden may as well be Germany or France. You're right up there now. I can't ever look at Sweden in the same way again.
You can keep your ABBA. I don't want ABBA. Exactly. It's all about the biscotto.
Yeah, exactly. This false perception of Swedes as gentle, blonde, friendly people is not for me.
Your IKEA, you can keep it. Don't want it.
Keep your IKEA. Yeah, exactly. Vafankul IKEA. So Italy make hard work of the Bulgaria game, don't they, Emmett? I mean, it's hard watching again.
Well, I'll start this off by saying this. Corrado, what's his name?
Starting. Corradi.
Corradi. Bernardo fucking Corradi. Yeah, seriously, you're trying to win a game of football and you start him up front. What is Trapattoni thinking? Italy should have been eliminated from the competition for that decision alone. Seriously, like I know Christian Vieri had been in a bad run of form and Trapattoni essentially drops him. Mm. But I mean, come on. Like,
change his system again so he goes 4-3-3 this time.
Yeah, I mean, Trapp is just endlessly tinkering here, trying to get something. It's like he's throwing stuff at a wall to see what sticks. It was a 4-2-3-1, and then it was a 4-3-1-2, and now he goes to a 4-3-3. But, like, you're starting Bernardo Corradi. Seriously. Like, me and you could have played in that team and did a better job. He wasn't even in... It wasn't like he had a wonder season and won Capo Cannonieri or was in the top, you know, five top goal scorers in Serie A that season. Like, he wasn't even in the top 10. Like, Robbie Baggio was ahead of him, and Robbie Baggio, to me, should have went to the tournament. I've said this every single episode, Baggio should have went. But, I mean, Alberto Gilardino breaking onto the scene with Parma, 23 goals, Trapp leaves him at home. And he brings, you're just thinking, you're trying to win the game here, Trapp. What are you doing? I know he maybe wants a big, burly centre forward to replace Vieri, But just go with Cassano and Del Piero or whatever. Anybody. Trap, get your boots, come you on. Anybody but... I mean, that epitomizes this struggle that Italy had at this tournament. They're just, Trapattoni just making one bad decision after another. But Bulgaria take the lead. Amori Petrov penalty near the end of the first
half.
That
even in itself was, I think, remember, disputed penalty. So again, it fed into this, the world's against Italy. It's been set up with... They want us out. No one wants Italy to go through kind of mentality.
Yeah, the world's against us.
Yeah, exactly.
But then Italy come out at the start of the second half. Kind of Trapp obviously realises, right, we are sinking here. And they come out all guns blazing. Simone Perrotta scores after, I think, a Cassano shot bounces off the crossbar. And I think it was actually over the line. You know, it would have been given nowadays as a Cassano goal, but... I think it's one of those where it just bounces over the line and comes out, and then Simone Perrotta volleys it in to make it 1-1, like within 3 minutes after the restart. But I remember Gigi Buffon making some decent saves. I remember there was a Petrov free kick from 25 yards out, and Buffon, and Petrov had a really good left foot on him, and Buffon makes a really good save. And it's a pouring rain. I mean, like, the rain's just... bucketing down.
That's which made it even more dramatic. Cassano's tears at the end on his knees. soaked with the rain.
And then Cassano scores, like, right at the death. Cassano scores a beautiful goal. I think it's a cutback from, is it Panucci? Yeah. Zambrata? It cut it back.
Lovely finish.
And Cassano just wraps his foot around it and just sends it flying into the roof of the net. And you're just thinking, jubilation, we're through. And then obviously someone has a word in his ear saying, well, Sweden and Denmark is 2-2, and we're going home. And Cassano just isn't taking, like,
he's just crushed, isn't he?
He's just crushed in that 15 second window. He goes from jubilation to dejection. He can't believe it, what's going on. But again, it's kind of, as we have alluded to, it was too little, too late, you know. I'm wondering
too late, 100%.
If Italy score more against Bulgaria, do they go through? Like, if they win 3-1 or 4-1?
I don't think they do. I think that was the 2-2 was the result that everyone looked at and said, no matter what Italy do, because of the head-to-head between Italy, Sweden and Denmark, that no matter what they did against Bulgaria, if it finished 2-2, that would have given Sweden and Denmark a better head-to-head against each other because Italy had drawn 0-0 and 1-1.
Ah, okay.
And so that was why the Italian press jumped on it straight away, and that's why there was such a big, because it wasn't even like, well, yes, of course Italy had the capability to go out and score 4 or 5 goals against Bulgaria, but even if they'd done that, because then you still could have said, well, actually, it's our own fault, we didn't score 4 or 5 goals, Sweden managed to, so why couldn't Italy? It was the fact that that result knocked Italy out, come what may. And I remember, I think it was particularly devastating for Cassano, because I think Cassano was still only 22 at the time.
Yeah, it was his first tournament.
His first tournament. That was a breakout, if you like, tournament for him in an Azzurri shirt. And to fill Totti's boots and potentially have been the man, the saviour, if you like, to rescue Italy would have been a huge moment in his young career.
Yeah.
And to have that kind of stripped away from him.
He was the one bright spark. Of the whole tournament. Literally the
Sant'Antonio.
Yeah. Probably the only one that walked away from Euro 2004 with any credit. You know, yeah, maybe Pirlo too. Yeah, Buffon. But out of all the attackers, Cassano was the only one that walks away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, and this is where I'll play devil's advocate, after that game, you have the kind of repercussions and the speculation and the hysteria in the Italian press. The following morning, one of the Swedish newspapers just had a huge 2-2 on the front page with "Congratulations, Italy, you tipped correctly," in brackets, as well as "Sorry, Italy, you are out," which obviously absolutely sent the Italian press and the Italian footballing world into overdrive, confirmed all their suspicions. Milan's vice president at the time, Adriano Galliani, comes out and says, we got as many points as the players who are blonde and beautiful, but we're darker and not as beautiful. Not sure what he's trying to infer there. Some form of racism towards Italians being darker skin. I'm not sure, which is quite rich. But I think, I think obviously there is an element in the back of the Swedish and Danish players' minds when it gets to the scoreline of 2-1, I think, and the Danes are leading. Of course, the Danish know they're through come what may in the last 5-10 minutes, because if Sweden score, they're not going to try and score again. So automatically they take their foot off the gas. And again, the Italian press get hold of some comments that were allegedly made during the game or between Swedish and Danish players. So apparently during the warm-up, Erik Edman, the Swedish defender, I think, or Swedish midfielder, asked Daniel Jensen from Denmark, should we go for the 2-2? To which the Danish defender smiled and said, yeah, why not? And then the Swedish Edman says, okay, you concede first. And then during the game, Anders Andersen apparently shouts out to the Danes, come on, bloody hell, give us a break now. And Thomas Gravenson replies when they're losing 2-1, yes, but you at least have to get forward and look like you're trying to score, kind of thing. And then after the game, I remember images used in the Italian press, I think they honed in on this, of the Swedish striker Marcus Ullback, and it was his Danish teammate at Aston Villa, Thomas Sorensen, jumping on his back after the game. I think looking like they were basically celebrating, and I think Ullback realises what this is going to look like and kind of gets him off, kind of, what are you doing? Like, why are you celebrating with me, kind of thing? This is going to look awful. So this all fed, as we said, the sense of victimhood, the conspiracy theory, not our fault. They played out of biscotto. We were doomed to fail. But as you said, Emmett, and correctly, and we can all look back at it, the Italians... It was one of those classic tournament performances where a very talented squad, underwhelming first game, rude missed chances in the second, and it was too little too late by the third, and only had themselves to blame. Trapp obviously leaves after the tournament. Lippi's brought in, the rest is history, in 2006, where they built up a siege mentality surrounding Calciopoli in a different way, in a more positive way, and they put the kind of wrongs of 2002 and 2004 to right. But looking back on it, I think as a young kid watching Italy and having had the kind of despair of Euro 2000 and the heartbreak of France and the golden goal, this was the first real memory that I had of, because 98 you lost to French in the World Cup quarter final host nation on penalties. You can stomach that. 2000, very unlucky. 2002, very disappointing. This was the kind of highest level of disappointment I remember as a young kid watching an Italian side at a major tournament with the talent that Trapattoni had at his disposal.
Yeah, I think that's the thing with the Trapp era. It's the players that he had at his disposal and how bad Italy were for those 4 years. Because, I mean, you have to look at also, like, look at the 2002 World Cup. Like, Italy scraped out of that group. Out of their group.
Again, yeah. Mexico 1-0 in the last game.
Yeah, Del Piero. Del Piero scored a header. Considering Trapp was the wrong choice. I mean, the game had passed Trapattoni by 2000. He comes in after Dino Zoff resigns following criticism from Silvio Berlusconi after France win on golden goal. And Trapp comes in. And by 2000, the game had passed Trapp by. Trapp was still ultra-conservative. Not exactly Catenaccio, but he wasn't going to go out and beat teams 3-4, 5-0 or take the game by the scruff the way Roberto Mancini's Italy side are currently doing. So he was the wrong choice. And then you just look at that era, that 2000 to 2004 era, and you just see the players that he had at his disposal. And say someone like Antonio Conte, his era as Italy manager, Conte would have killed to have players of that quality. And you just think...
Or they would have killed him. Cassano, Totti, Del Piero. I'm not sure how he would have coped with that level of precocious talent going forward when he made do with Eder and Pelle up top.
Yeah, he probably would have put Vieri and Del Piero as wing-backs. He loves a 3-5-2. You just have a whole team full of wing-backs.
Exactly. But no, I think even... you go back and you look at the Prandelli side of 2012 and didn't have the level of talent. It was a good side, but didn't have that level of talent and played a lot more progressively and positively 2016, as you said, and through to today. You know, I think after the World Cup, those two tournaments before 2006 and then the two tournaments after, albeit Italy lost on penalties to Spain in 2008. And if they'd got through that, who knows, they could have gone on to win another tournament.
Yeah, were I think it's a disappointment. It's sad too, in the fact that when you see how good Cassano did at Euro 2004, how he basically, he goes into the international wilderness for the next 4 years.
2012.
You know, he plays, yeah. He gets selected for Euro 2008, but he misses out on the World Cup 2 years later. You know, Lippi doesn't call on him. At this point, he's at Real Madrid and he's eating pastries and having sex with prostitutes.
Too much Nutella, yeah. Yeah.
Like, he's been completely off the rails. And Cassano's like 24, and that's, you know, he should be at his peak. And he should be part of that Italy squad winning the World Cup. But he's not. Yeah. Donadoni includes him in Euro 2008. And then he doesn't play in the 2010 World Cup. And then he's back kind of at his peak at Euro 2012. So you kind of feel sad for Cassano. I suppose, in a way, again, it's his own fault. You know, if he had instead have disciplined, he probably would have made the plane for Germany. But you just think, at 22, he had the world at his feet. He was such a talent. And just to see him spend so many years. I mean, Cassano ends up with what? Maybe 40 caps for Italy? Not even? Like, that's
crazy.
Criminal for a player of his talent. And this tournament, you know, demonstrated how precocious he was and how good he was at such a young age. And that's the sad part for me. It's just when you see how good he was, what didn't happen with him?
Yeah. And I think it was a shame that obviously in 2012, you just met the greatest side, one of the greatest international sides in footballing history in Spain at the peak of their powers. But it was a shame that he didn't get that redemption almost with the Italian national side in 2012. Look, he played a massive part in them reaching the final, but it was one step too far against that Spanish side. But I was glad to see him be an integral part of that side. Just a shame they couldn't get over the line. But yeah, let's hope that obviously, you know, the different, especially for tonight, we're going to see a very different Italian side playing against Spain, which should be a fantastic game at Wembley, and which I'm looking forward to attending later on. But Emmett, I know you would just finish off with some questions from our followers about this tournament and about the Italian national side, to wrap this particular episode of the podcast and put this Euro 2004 right back in the vault and right behind us and get it out of the mind
forever.
Forever, exactly.
We put questions out to our audience on Twitter, and Mad About Football asked first, he sent in 5 questions, but we've kind of covered the other 4, so I'll just start with this one. Number 1, should Baggio have been included in the squad? What do you think?
I think definitely for Bernardo Carardi, it would have definitely been a suitable replacement. I think, I mean, even watching the Baggio film recently brought home the hard work that he'd done to perform and keep himself, or recover and keep himself fit to be available for those international tournaments for Italy, because that's where he produced. I think even to have brought him off the bench in games like Denmark and Sweden, where he could have created something out of nothing and potentially nicked Italy a 1-0 or a 2-1 win, would have been worth it, even if it was 10, 20-minute cameos at the end of games when you need him to come up with a bit of magia, as we say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every podcast that we've done in this series, one of the first things I would say to Richard is that Baggio should have been there, you know, because Baggio famously never played at the Euros, never once, never got a single, was never called
crazy
upon. 96, Sacchi, you know, omitted him. Euro 2000, Zoff omitted him. Trapattoni here omitted him. So he never played a single minute. So I feel maybe that Euro 2004 was a step too far. But then I remembered that he called upon Bernardo Corradi, and I'm thinking, no, I would have taken a 45-year-old Baggio than Bernardo Corradi. I mean, you'd Luca Toni in Serie B for Palermo smashing in 30 goals. I would have taken Luca Toni as opposed to Bernardo fucking Corradi. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but yeah, as you say, Baggio, you'd bring him on 10, 15 minutes at the end. You know, I don't think at this point he was 37. He wasn't demanding to be a starter. But you bring him on as an impact sub, you give him the ball, and he would create magic. You know, as you said,
And this is the gentleman ultra. We've got to be romantic about these kind of things. We've got to be look back nostalgically and say, of course, there's a place for Robbie, even if he is 50.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I probably would have bringing him to this Euros, to be honest with you. to him, his boots go here, right, Robbie, come on for 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Simon Owens writes in and says, why did Vieri struggle so much in this Euros when he had been world class for Italy at France 98? And Korea and Japan 02?
It's a very good question. Because I think we touched upon it earlier, didn't we? It was baffling his form in front of goal in terms of finishing, because he was in the midst, towards the back end of that incredible spell with Inter, where he scores over 100 goals in what was it, 140, 50 games.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous ratio.
Exactly. It wasn't like a precedent of, right, he's coming to the end of his powers here. There was no sign of that. And you look at the players around him, it may have been because of what you mentioned, Emmett, the style of play, the system, the reactive approach and the conservative approach of Trapp just didn't suit Vieri, who I think he was a brilliant forward and could bring other players into the game and could be that prima punta and that focus, that focal point. But he did need a supporting cast. He always needed people delivering balls into the box, playing, using his movement to either get him behind or receive the ball in areas where he could bring other players into the game or turn and strike. And I think maybe the system wasn't the right system to free up the players around him to allow them to create maybe as many. But then you see how many chances he missed, for example, in the Sweden game, he misses two or three where you think, Bob Vieri normally at least scores one of those. So it's one of those where I think every striker has a tournament like that.
Yeah. I think for Vieri, maybe it was a tournament too far, in the sense that in 2002-2003, I think he wins the Capo Cannonieri Award. He gets 24 goals in 24 games, something ridiculous. But then he starts to pick up niggling injuries. And then you get to, it's obviously Euro 2004 is a year later. And I think he only gets 13 maybe for Inter in that season. So I think, and he's a big frame. And obviously Bobo loved the lifestyle. You know, he wasn't he wasn't Cristiano Ronaldo or Ibra taking care of his body.
Running through this Italian team, actually. Cassano, Vieri, Totti.
He's 30 or 31, and I think it maybe was just a tournament too far. But another sports writer, that's his Twitter handle, that's not his actual name, writes in, related to Bobo, was it a coincidence that side seemed to do better after he left, i.e. Italy in 06 and Inter's title streak in the late noughties?
That is a very good question as well.
I suppose when you have it with someone like Vieri, you have to play it to him. And then when you take him out, others, you know, the side kind of becomes more cohesive, more fluid.
Yeah.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. I think there's definitely some logic to that, because I think if you look at the 2006 side, you did have a focal point like Vieri in Luca Toni, but Toni, I think, was a different kind of profile. He wasn't that protagonista, was he, up front, that Vieri was, as you said, that not everything had to go through him. And also, if you took him out of the side, I don't think you noticed it as much, with all due respect to Toni, because he was a fantastic forward. I think you're right there. I think, Vieri, at the peak of his powers, everyone wants him in the side, of course he does, but the factors that you mentioned in the question before, combined with the fact that he was such an integral part, and he, you know, you very much try and build a system and a team around him, that you take him out and maybe things do become more cohesive and you're not so reliant on that focal point or that one player up front that you're expecting to score the goals, because you look at 2006 and the goals came from everywhere.
Yeah, and it was sad in a way too that Vieri missed out on that also, you know, as well as Cassano. I mean, at that point, Vieri would have been 33. And remember, he joins Milan. He goes directly from Inter to Milan, and he's at Milan for like a cup of coffee. And then he goes to Monaco on loan. Like, and he
8 games, doesn't he?
Yeah. And he cracks his knee, I think, like 2 months before the 2006 World Cup. And I think for Vieri, it's painful because he grew up with a lot of that side, you know, Del Piero, Tari, Buffon, Cannavaro, Nesta. Gattuso, they all grew up together, but Vieri got left out. And you always kind of think, if he hadn't have got injured before the start of Euro 2000, when he was at his absolute peak, if Italy would have won that tournament, you know, that probably could have been his tournament.
You've got to say, I mean, he's going to take one of those chances in the final, isn't he?
Yeah, the Del Piero misses.
I mean, he's going to score. I mean, and again, fantastic depth, Del Vecchio, and who came in and scored the goal. But you've got to say that Vieri buries one of those chances in the final against France.
Yeah, absolutely. We have one last question here from Mohamed Rayad Al Lawati. Apologies, Mohamed, if I butchered
the pronunciation of your name.
Apologies.
Done well there, mate.
In the last match against Bulgaria, why did Trapattoni start with Karate instead of Vieri or Inzaghi? I think...
Fantastic place to leave this podcast.
This question just epitomizes the entire tournament, so I suppose it's a good way to finish off. I think maybe Karate had, you know, I don't know, he had something on Trapattoni, naked pictures or something. I don't know why he starts with Trapattoni or with Karate. I have absolutely no idea. I mean, as bad a form as Vieri was in, surely he's a better option than Bernardo Corradi. Surely.
Yeah, I think, I don't know whether it was, you know, was it Trapp trying to do something, thinking outside the box, and Corradi has the game of his life, and he's, you know, and then Trapp's suddenly a genius. I don't know. One of those kind of ego calls where you think, I'm going to surprise the opposition. I'm not sure. I think, like you said, it was a very bad decision, which really captured Italy's tournament in that moment where Corradi gets subbed anyway after I think 50 odd minutes, and as we've said, it all ends in tears for the Italians, and I think a very suitable place to kind of shelve that dreadful moment in Italian football history.
Yeah.
And look forward to hopefully a much better one tonight against Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can bury Euro 2004, put it in the, consign it to history, put it in the archives, and we'll move on.
Yeah, exactly that. But no, thanks, Emmett. It's been a pleasure reliving painful moments. as warped as that seems.
We're masochists, Luca.
Yeah, exactly. As contradictory as that seems. Thanks, guys, all our followers, for the questions. Forza Italia for tonight. And we'll be back next time with another episode of the Gentleman Ultra podcast. This is Luca and Emmett signing out. Grazie, ragazzi. Ciao.